And there's been a lot of news recently. So we are well into 2024.
2025.
I did that last time too. I'm totally in denial. Hello and welcome to Rolling Forward.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
And we're a pediatrician and psychiatrist that's helping you navigate through the news.
We're recording this on Tuesday, January 21st, 2025, which I mentioned because today is the day after Trump's inauguration as president.
And there's already so many things that we could talk about.
On his first day in office, Trump signed a number of executive orders. And today we really wanted to highlight one particular policy, given its potential to impact youth.
So we're specifically going to talk about the executive order entitled Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government.
And I have to tell you, when I hear that title, it just makes me think of when Trump said on the campaign trail that he was going to defend women, whether they liked it or not.
It just makes me feel a little icky.
Yeah. And this policy is really focused on this conservative idea about biology determining gender and not subjective belief. And it defines sex as a binary variable, saying that there's only two sexes, male and female.
When we know from science that actually is not necessarily true.
There were some parts in this executive order that were really confusing to me. One was that this executive order created this binary set of sexes, okay, male and female, I've heard that. But then it didn't define sex based on chromosomes, but rather on small and large reproductive cells. Terms I've literally never heard before.
So, Stephanie, can you tell me a little bit more about what defines sex? And what does this mean with small and large reproductive cells?
Essentially, this is a term that comes from developmental biology. And I've done more than a decade of medical training and never heard small and large reproductive cells. I wondered if that was because maybe I'm not an OBGYN, maybe I'm not in this business. But within my social circles, where I have a number of friends who are trained in these disciplines, it wasn't terms that they were familiar with either. And it turns out that these terms come from developmental biology, and they focus on gametes that people have. In this case, we're talking about eggs being the large reproductive cells and sperm being the small reproductive cells.
So it sounds like you're saying they're defining biological sex based on whether you create eggs or ova or sperm. And that sounds like that could be a problem because there are a number of people that don't produce either eggs or sperm.
But this is a binary, Alicia. There's one choice or the other. So according to this, I guess we're going to ignore the group of people who may not have gametes. And the second issue with this is that this executive order specifically defines the presence of gametes at conception. And the reality is, gametes are not present at conception. It takes quite a while of fetal development before a fetus has gametes. You do have genetic material that down the line may lead to the production of these gametes, although, as we said, certain people have different disorders in which they don't produce gametes. That genetic material is there, but the gametes, these small and large reproductive cells, are not present at conception because you are one cell. And so there are some issues with how this executive order is defining sex, but it essentially is making the point that has often been made by the GOP that sex is binary, it's male or female, and that's it. And although how they defined it was surprising, the fact that they're pushing this kind of agenda forward is something that has consistently been brought up on the campaign trail and not necessarily that surprising. So just a few years ago, there wasn't a single state that had any laws banning gender-affirming care for youth. And we're currently in a place where about half of states have laws that ban youth, people under 18, from accessing gender-affirming care.
So gender-affirming care is a type of healthcare that supports gender-diverse individuals in aligning their physical traits with their gender identity.
under this current administration and with this executive order, it seems like we're going to see these restrictions just grow. They also really want to impose this belief on institutions, meaning this executive action is going to require federal governments to use this term sex rather than gender.
The difference between sex and gender, sex typically medically refers to your like biological sex or the sex that you were born as, and gender usually refers to your gender expression or how you identify. So for example, you could have the same sex and gender. I identify as female and I was born as a female. So you could be born female but identify as male, or you could be born male and identify as gender fluid or gender non-binary.
Absolutely. So under this executive order, the things we'll expect to see is now the federal government is going to refer to sex only and not gender. And that includes a direction to the State Department and Homeland Security to use sex only on different documents like passports and visas instead of gender, which is going to affect people who are gender diverse and who may have a difference between their gender and their sex.
So part of the transitioning process for a lot of people includes changing their identity on their legal documents, such as driver's license or passports, and they may have already done this. And so this might be difficult, especially for people on visas, in the upcoming few weeks to months.
And another part of this executive action is preventing taxpayer funds from being used for gender transition healthcare. So currently there are a number of ways that gender diverse individuals, including gender diverse youth, may be using taxpayer funds for gender affirming healthcare, such as through some of the state funded and federally funded health insurance programs that we've talked about in prior episodes.
The executive order will also ban transgender and gender diverse individuals from government funded single sex facilities that best align with their gender identity rather than their sex. This includes housing, domestic violence shelters, prisons, etc. It also will put in a requirement that at government workplaces, you will need to be referred to your birth sex pronouns rather than your pronouns of choice.
And this is aligned with actions that we've seen recently from people in the GOP. All of these parts of the executive order are targeting gender diverse individuals and trying to limit access to gender affirming care. And this type of medical care is considered safe and medically necessary by major healthcare associations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, and the Endocrine Society. So within medicine, there is consensus over the safety, efficacy, and medical necessity of these types of treatments. One group that we've seen really singled out, and the reason that we chose to focus this episode on this topic, is because gender-affirming care for youth has become an extremely controversial topic.
There's this idea that exposing children to different gender identities or different sexual orientations increases the, quote, risk of them developing these traits or these identities themselves.
That is such a backwards statement. Everything about that statement is so backwards, an idea and also a risk. But yes.
Trump has made it very clear that his priority is to ban all gender-affirming care for minors.
And our concern about these bans are, number one, not just denying medically necessary healthcare to kids, but also, number two, the impact that that has on kids' mental health. Overall, research suggests that people who are gender diverse, who want and receive gender-affirming care, have lower rates of suicide attempts than people who do not receive that care, people who want it and are denied it. So part of the concern with these new restrictions being put in place is how that's going to impact the mental health of youth.
There currently is a case in the Supreme Court that's being reviewed called U.S. versus Scarametti. It is based on the Tennessee ban on gender-affirming care for youth. The case was argued at the beginning of December. No opinion or vote has been made public yet, but it does seem like the court is planning to uphold the ban, and the decision is expected by the summer.
And we'll be talking about that decision as it comes out. But now for the moment, what I think is important to focus on is how to help support youth. And it's hard to know exactly how many youth are gender diverse, especially with these policies in place that are penalizing families, that are penalizing physicians, that are penalizing people for accessing care. So it can be hard to know, but it's expected that somewhere between 1 to 2% of kids who are 13 to 17 are gender diverse.
Very few kids under 13 actually identify as gender diverse, but they tend to be the most talked about in the media.
But Alicia, I saw one story on TikTok once by one person about one experience. Is that not everything?
All facts.
And I've already started to see impacts of this at work. So I provide emergency psychiatric care. And in that setting, I have seen an increase in the number of gender diverse youth coming in reporting depression and suicidal thoughts.
I've seen a similar trend in the pediatric emergency department. A large portion of our teens that are presenting with thoughts of suicide or suicidal ideation are identifying as gender diverse. It seems like this is a really dire note that we've been taking a lot of steps backwards in the past few years, in the past few months, in the past week. But it's important to remember that we've been in this place before on a lot of other subjects and have moved forward and have made a lot of progress. In 2004, Bush's State of the Union specifically said, in quote, "Our nation must defend the sanctity of marriage," and he advocated for a constitutional amendment to protect marriage. After that State of the Union, in the next few months to years, 27 states enacted state constitutional amendments that banned same-sex marriage. And the public opinion was not very supportive of same-sex marriage at the time. Obama was elected. He initially did not endorse legalizing same-sex marriage. But over the kind of next decade after Bush's State of the Union, we start seeing changes in public opinion. We start to see progress. We start to see change. And in 2015, the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in a ruling of Obergefell versus Hodge.
And we've seen similar patterns with civil rights and women's rights where there can be these steps backwards in policies with restrictive laws being put into place before eventually public opinion and the Supreme Court and the rule of law moves forward. And that's really the point of our podcast and why we named ourselves Rolling Forward, Roland being our last name, but also the idea that we are going to continue rolling forward. And we believe in science and the ability of science to help parents make good decisions about what's right for their families. And so with that, a lot of this topic feels very heavy. We also want to offer some ways to help support the kids in your life, friends and family members that you may have. And one way to really highlight this is to say, do not be afraid to have a conversation with your child about mental health, about depression, and to ask directly whether they're having suicidal thoughts.
I think there's this misconception that if you ask a child if they're having suicidal thoughts, that you'll encourage them or you'll plant the idea in their mind. Asking a child about suicide, asking a child if they're having suicidal thoughts, does not increase their risk of having suicidal thoughts, does not increase their risk of suicide, and does not plant any ideas in their head.
And it can be hard to ask these questions. I'm a psychiatrist, and so I'm used to asking these questions now. I ask these questions every single day. But when I was first starting off in psychiatry and I felt awkward, uncomfortable, one of the things that I did was I role played. And Alicia, you weren't yet in medical school then, but I would ask you questions. I would ask you to act like you were someone that I was talking to as if you were my patient. And I would practice saying the questions until I got more comfortable. So if this is a conversation that you want to have with your child, you can seek out and practice that conversation with other adults in your life until it feels more natural. And also, it's okay if it feels awkward. Asking the question, starting the conversation is what's important. And sometimes difficult conversations are awkward, but we still have them.
Like, these conversations are awkward. I agree with that.
They're so awkward sometimes.
They're super awkward. I like walk in the room and be like, "Hi, I've never met you before. Are you going to kill yourself? Do you have thoughts about not waking up?"
Sometimes the way that I start, so what's your...
It's not how I start, but that's what it feels like.
What's your favorite way to ask someone about suicide?
I tend to start with other subject matters and build a rapport with a patient before I immediately ask them about risk of suicide.
I also do that. I don't just go in. But when you do broach it, what's your favorite way of asking?
I start with passive suicidal ideation before I get to active. So I ask people if they have thoughts about not wanting to wake up or wishing that they were dead before I ask them if they have thoughts about wanting to hurt themselves.
I actually do that exact same thing. I ask people, my go-to to start this conversation after we have rapport, after we're on that page, is, do you ever feel so overwhelmed that you wish that you were dead? Do you ever wish you could go to sleep and not wake up? And then from there, if someone says yes, then I do start to ask more. Do you ever have thoughts about acting to end your own life? Have you made plans of what you might do? And that helps me gauge the seriousness of where they are. So some other tips for these conversations, recognizing that these conversations are awkward. It's also hard for our kids to feel that way. And so asking about it is opening the door for them to be able to share with you something that they might already be feeling themselves. It's really important in these conversations to not offer a quick fix or a solution. We often just want our kids to feel better. And so we say, oh, that won't happen, or it's so here's something we can try. But when someone's feeling this way, giving them a quick fix is going to shut down that conversation. You know, they've thought about a lot of this before, and these are big topics that we're talking about today. There isn't a quick fix to what's going on, and acting as if there is really going to make a kid shut down.
Instead of offering a quick fix or a solution, I recommend asking open-ended questions. Things like, can you say more about that? I'm sorry that you're feeling that way, and I want to understand more about your perspective.
And validate and support how they feel. Really sit with them in that moment, like Alicia is saying, and offer that validation. And it's never too early to start these conversations. My daughter is not yet two, and when we were on vacation last week, we were browsing around some bookstores, and I saw a book called Going to the Therapist that was for kids. And yes, I am a therapist, I'm a psychiatrist, but I bought it for her. And it's part of our rotation. It's a book about kids go to therapy because they're feeling sad or their belly hurts a lot and they don't want to go to school. There's all these different scenarios of kids experiencing different challenges and how going to a therapist has helped them. And I think having that in our household, reading that to my one-year-olds, having her grow up knowing that asking for help is a sign of strength, it's never too early to start these conversations.
There's language that you can use, I think, especially for younger kids. You can ask a little bit more about physical symptoms for younger kids. Younger kids tend to get belly aches when they're actually having like mental health distress. Belly aches tends to be a big thing in younger kids. And so asking them about tummy aches, if they're getting tummy aches more often, if they're like getting more upset, if they feel like they're getting more angry recently, I think for younger kids that can be helpful because they don't really have the knowledge of or like the perception of their feelings yet. I think for older kids, it becomes a little bit more nuanced because they have a better understanding. And so you can ask them specific questions like, are you having trouble with sleep? Are you seeing mood changes? Have you been experiencing feelings of hopelessness or feeling trapped or overwhelmed?
You know what? Your kid might not be ready to talk. You might get the eye roll and the, oh, mom, you know, and they're not ready, but that's okay. You leave the invitation open. You say, whenever you want to talk, I'm here to listen and support you. I'm not going to judge you. I'll never stop supporting you. No matter what challenges you face, we are a team and I'm here with you.
And then in addition to having these difficult conversations, I think a really important part of mental health and mental health care particularly for tweens and teens is knowing when to seek professional help and seeking professional help. Honestly, I think that everyone will benefit from talk therapy at any age.
I was just talking to a family member today and recommending, have you thought about therapy? And, you know, different people feel different ways about therapy. Understandably, there's a stigma around mental health care, but therapy is a way that you take care of yourself. You go to the gym. You go to therapy. This is part of self-care. And so if you're noticing things about your child's behavior that is concerning you, reach out for professional help. That doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. That doesn't mean that you've done anything wrong. Mental health is a part of health. And the same way we go to a pediatrician, kids can go to therapy.
I just want to say really quickly, it can be really hard to find a therapist that accepts your insurance, that's in your region, that is available for children. The first thing that I always recommend is to flip your insurance card over if you have insurance. There'll be a phone number to call and they'll help connect you to mental health resources.
Absolutely. That is a great tip to call that number on the back and try to get connected. Different locations also have helplines that you can call for professional help. These used to be known as suicide hotlines, but nowadays they're much more warehouses of mental health support services. So in New York City, where I practice, the suicide hotline has just become a mental health helpline, and they have appointments and different things available. So look for your local hotline and see if you can call and get any support in accessing resources. And you know your child, and you know their baseline, you know what they're like. And I think parents have that spidey sense of when something's wrong. Some of the things that you can look for is if someone is really withdrawing from others or engaging in some type of self-harm. And talking about death and suicide, even if it's joking, those aren't jokes. If somebody's saying it, it's something that they're thinking about.
Something to look out for is dramatic changes in your mood, including suddenly being really happy. I think if someone has been very moody and really withdrawn and spending a lot of time alone, and all of a sudden is really happy, engaging in activities, and starting to do things like giving away their possessions, it's a concerning sign.
As well as posting about death, dying, suicide, anything like that on social media, talking about it with their friends, I would take actions like that pretty seriously. And then thinking about whether there are changes in substance use, risky behaviors, things like that. Oh, and mood changes, withdrawal, these are things that happen in kids. These are things that happen in adolescents. So it's really looking for things that are dramatic, sudden changes, very out of character. And then my biggest tip with this, and you have heard me say this so many times, my husband has heard me say this so many times, but strike when the iron is cold. So the time to have this conversation is not when the iron is hot and everyone's engaged in a shouting match in the kitchen. That's not the time to be, hey, you want to talk about this executive order, how it's making you feel, and do you think you want to go to sleep and not wake up? The time is not when the iron is hot, energies are high, and people have a lot of affect already. The time to talk about this is when the iron is cold. It's a Saturday afternoon, it's rainy, everyone's kind of sitting around reading, maybe by the fireplace, having a cup of tea, everything's calm. And you ask, hey, I've been wanting to ask you about this. And that's when you bring it up.
I feel like car rides are a great time to ask because one, you're stuck in the car.
It's true.
And two, not being face to face, but rather being side by side can sometimes be helpful.
It's so funny because as someone who trained in New York City, I have never suggested a car ride to anyone. Like, no, none of my patients ever had cars or car rides. And certainly I can imagine doing that in an Uber. Be like, yeah, get in the Uber. Do it then with a third person that you don't know. That'll be great. So those are our tips. These are difficult conversations. Remember that there's hope. There is forward motion that will come. And keeping open, honest communication with your kids, letting them know that you are a resource that they can count on. Rolling forward, And that's our podcast for today. We will keep following these updates with you. You can reach out to us on social media. We are Rolling Forward, R-O-L-I-N, forward, show, at gmail.com. We're also Rolling Forward, R-O-L-I-N, forward, on X, Blue Sky, Instagram, the different platforms. You can reach out to us and let us know what you're thinking about.
We're on the socials.
We are on the socials.
Reach out, let us know if there's any new changes that you're confused about, that you're worried about, that you'd like us to talk about in more detail. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for your time. You just kept asking me questions that I don't know.
I was trying to engage you in a conversation. I think something unique about your bookshelf is that it's really focused on reducing stigma. You have a book about a male nurse. You'll have books about female firefighters.
A book, Everyone Poops. Gotta reduce that stigma. Everyone Poops. That's a current favorite. A book about consent.
We're working on potty training.
Yeah, that's the phase of parenting I'm in right now.